How did Samuel Johnson's dictionary ever come to be?
Why did he hate the word compliment?
And why did he include the words dog bolt, fop doodle, and foop?
Today we're talking about our friend Sam Johnson, his landmark 1755 dictionary, and the quirks, cantankerousness, and curiosities found within its storied pages on this episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Safaris, author of etymology books like this one, which just got a print copy of.
Oh, that's the first hard copy of Useless Etymology that I've seen.
Oh, I'm so excited. It's the first one I've seen too. But today we're talking about a different book, one that I mention several times in Useless Etymology, which again, for our podcast listeners, I am holding a book.
A very beautiful book.
Oh, so pretty. Today we're talking about Samuel Johnson, who is not just a meme of a man squinting at a piece of paper, but the author of arguably the most important English language dictionary in history.
Yeah, I think it's very easy to say that, isn't it? It's not that his 1755 dictionary is the first dictionary by any stretch. We'll get into that during the course of this, but it is the first that is really recognizable to us as a dictionary in the way that we understand the word today.
The first definitive compilation of almost every English word in use to at least the society that he lived in until the publication of the Oxford English Dictionary 173 years later.
It's just an extraordinary undertaking. And we'll get into some of the fun, amusing, and also insightful stuff that is in there as we go through. But we perhaps need to get an understanding of the man and how the book comes about to start with, don't we, really?
Yeah. Tell me about Johnson's life.
I would gladly talk about it because he's sort of from my neck of the woods. He's about a 40-minute drive away from where I grew up. So I grew up in Derby in the English Midlands, and he is from Lichfield. Yeah, so he's from a humble background. You know, he's the son of a bookseller and a stationer. And yeah, born in 1709, he goes to Oxford, but has to drop out because his dad runs out of money. Then he gets married in controversial fashion to a woman who's a quarter of a century older than him. And he gets married in Derby, my hometown, actually. Yeah. And St. Werburgh's Church, where he got married, which is very, very beautiful, is next to a bar that he spent an awful lot of time in my late teens. The less said about that, the better. Then he goes down to London and yeah, he gets his first publishing job writing for the Gentleman's Magazine. And then 1746, he writes something called A Short Scheme for Compiling a New Dictionary of the English Language. And it is in this that he sets out his plan to write a comprehensive dictionary. At the time, he says one great end of this plan is to fix the English language. So the idea is that he's going to nail all these words down, their meanings, their spellings, maybe even their pronunciations. Okay, he kind of sheds that idea during the course of writing the thing, which, you know, is no small feat and no small effort. Jess, tell us about the dictionary that he ends up actually producing.
This is probably, you could argue, maybe like the fifth or sixth attempt at something like this, but nothing was ever so comprehensive. Sometimes the first one that most people consider to be anything resembling a dictionary is Robert Cawdrey's A Table Alphabetical, which was in 1604, but it only had 2,400 some odd words, and they were like hard words with definitions. So it was more like a vocabulary book than it was a dictionary. We also have Nathan Bailey's 1721 40,000 word English dictionary, which has broader coverage, but it also lacked literary depth, a consistent structure. The book that we eventually get on April 15th, 1755, first edition, was two gigantic folio volumes covering 42,773 words and about 114,000 literary quotations throughout. So it's not just definitions, it's examples, it's connections, it's lots of editorialization, which we will get into. And Johnson was the first to combine these precise definitions with these examples of them in usage. One of the things that made Johnson's Dictionary particularly useful and still makes it useful to us today is all of these usage notes, the commentary on register, on tone, on shifts, on words that don't exist anymore, words that are in use anymore, and who uses those words, and then examples of them in context, which makes it a lot more useful than some of the other ones that we have looked at in the past.
What I really enjoyed reading about was how they actually went about compiling this, because he didn't work alone. He had assistants who helped him. And he spent the first 3 years of making this just reading through text after text after text after text after text, looking for examples of the usage of words. 3 years he spent doing that. Then his poor assistants had to copy down each of those quotations onto a little slip of paper, which they then filed away, and then began the onerous task of writing definitions. And then when they were done, they got the definitions, which were on slips of paper. They got the quotations that were on slips of paper. They stuck them onto a much bigger bit of paper and sent it to the printers. It's wonderfully analog, as you'd expect.
That process also, like, that continued for some time after this too, in terms of lexicography, because that's also how Dord got introduced as a ghost word in a much later dictionary. This was not Johnson's time. It was a mix-up of slips. They were trying to type D-O-R. D and
right, it's capital D or lowercase d, right?
Yeah.
for density. Ghost word. So a ghost word is a word that should not be in the dictionary. And there are a few in this one, aren't there? Can you tell us about those?
Okay, so my favorite one, and I think everyone's favorite one because it sounds funny, is foop.
Foop.
which is defined as to drive with a sudden impetuosity. He says it's a word out of use, but the fact is it never was a word in use before. he quotes, he has a citation in there of a 16th century work by William Camden about the people of Britain. It says, "We pronounce by the confession of strangers as smoothly and moderately as any northern nations who foop their words out of their throats with fat and full spirits." And what the idea might be, like maybe swoop or just another word that's unrecognized here.
We've got a problem with that F and that F looking like an, well, yeah, that S looking like an F rather, right? And it's more likely that it was soup, but which is some sort of relation to swoop.
It must have been S-O-U-P-E is likely the word that was going there. But he was correct. That's not in use either. But he's also got a couple of, he has adventine, which is a misprint introduced in place of adventive. And then dentize, which is a misprint of dentire, which was meant to mean like tooth cutting, essentially. Both of those were from Francis Bacon's work. He lifted the quote and misread it, or someone did in the process, probably one of the people who was helping him assemble it.
And when you're putting together 42,000 plus words, it's difficult to apply the same level of effort to all of them, isn't it? Which is why it does fall short of his own standards occasionally. But he comes across as a very modest man, doesn't he, in the pages and in the descriptions. There is perhaps the most famous one is his definition of a lexicographer, of someone who writes dictionaries, where he describes them as a harmless drudge, which I think is a term that lexicographers today enjoy referring to themselves with.
I didn't read that exactly as humble necessarily, so much as like, ugh. You know, which he has another one along those lines too, doesn't he? I believe under the entry dull, it says something like to compile dictionaries is dull work. So both of those read to me as like,
But I like the way that he admits his mistakes. There are lots of entries in here where, for example, for dog bolt, he just writes, "Of this word, I know not the meaning." The same for stammel, "Of this word, I know not the meaning." Oh, they write that in the 1755 edition, but by the fourth edition, he's worked out what it means and he's replaced that with a species of red color. And there's also another one, which is "trolley my dames, of this word, I know not the meaning." And I don't think anyone does.
There are some fabulous words along these lines. He's very judgmental of many words and often many people.
Yeah.
And there are many words that he expressly does not like and explicitly says that he doesn't like them in the dictionary. And they're like words that we use all the time now.
He uses the word barbarous to describe a lot of words. If there's a word that he really doesn't like. There's some fun ones. Here's one that I really like that caught my attention. It's the word Ork, which is in there, A-W-K. And it is, as he describes it, a barbarous contraction of the word awkward, which is just like orcs. Ooh, orcs. I really like that one.
Oh, that's funny. That's relatable.
It is. He defines it as odd, out of order. He says he doesn't like the word finesse. He says it is an unnecessary word, which is creeping into our language.
Oh, he doesn't like when you introduce like French neologisms. Yeah. He doesn't like that at all. He hates the word rapport for the same reason.
Yeah, and there's another one. It's souvenance, right? Which means a sort of memory, right? And again, he leaves a little note in there saying, oh, thank goodness we're not using this French word that much anymore. He really doesn't like too many borrowings where, you know, there's a good old-fashioned Anglo-Saxon one to replace it.
He's got a bunch of, like, pedantry throughout. Some of my favorite, like, ordinary words that he calls low words or doesn't like. And part of that could certainly be that they're more commonly used among people who are not of his class.
Yeah, it might not be a value judgment when he says low.
But some of them are.
Yeah, I think so. They're said with they're written with a sneer.
Right, right. A couple of them that you know, whether value judgments or not, are clever, which he describes as a low word, which is scarcely ever used, but in burlesque and one without a settled meaning. And the idea was, at the time, clever was used to describe like manual dexterity and not intellectual dexterity. But he did like the word crack he thought it was a really good word for good things, which is older than I figured. Like if you're a crack shot at something, or on the A-team, if you're a crack commando unit.
Yeah.
That's one that he approved. I would also like to note one of his definitions for the word crack. And I'm so sorry, because according to Johnson, crack is a word for quote unquote a whore in low language, which also is older than I thought. I was assuming that was affiliated. I mean, it is affiliated with cocaine in the modern era, but but a prostitute called a crack apparently was also a thing as early as 1755. Cocaine be damned.
I do worry that it's an anatomical reference. I do worry. Oh.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
We're going to end up getting into some of the more raunchy yes. words in here, aren't we? I don't think we're going to be able to get past those.
They're not funny.
Before we get there, please, before we get there, a few more of the sneering definitions. One I really like is opinionary, which is a slightly odd word, but he describes it as, this word, though it has been tried in different forms, is not yet received, nor is it wanted.
Not wanted. Get out. Hey, listen, he is fair. He puts it in the dictionary, even if he doesn't want it.
This is true. He's trying to... So by this point, he has decided that trying to fix the language or tell people how to use it is a fool's errand. He compares, you know, trying to stick with such an aim to the people of the past who've searched for an elixir of eternal life. He says it's just not going to happen. So he is putting in every word that he can think of, and he's putting in the same word twice, just with different spellings at different places in the dictionary. Yeah, but he's just occasionally giving us a clue as to what he thinks of it. Another one's twittle twattle or twittle twattle, which he says is a vile word, a ludicrous reduplication of twattle.
How dare.
Twittle twattle.
Oh, that's good. He doesn't like the word width. He calls it a low word too. And it's because prior to the 1700s, the preferred word was wideness, and width was introduced on the same model as words like breadth and depth, which feels like logical parallelism to me. But we get all salty about semantic parallelism in modern phrasing too. Like in our grammar episode with Grammar Girl, we mentioned by accident and on accident, which is probably like a shift that parallels on purpose, right? The same thing happened with like width and breadth, apparently, but he does not like it. He also doesn't like lesser. The entry for this one, another barbarous one, a barbarous corruption of less, formed by the vulgar form, the habit of terminating comparatives in ER, afterward adopted by poets and then by writers of prose, till it has all the authority which a mode originally erroneous can derive from custom.
I wonder what he'd make of the fewer, lesser debate.
Oh, man.
He does crack the occasional joke, though, doesn't he?
He does.
We should mention the entry for oats, isn't it?
He describes it as food for horses in England and food for people in Scotland.
Yeah, that's right. He's basically, I think it's so a lot of the people that are his assistants are Scottish, I think, because there's a lot of Scottish slang that there's no reason he should know it, being a guy from Lichfield working in London. And so I think the assumption is that a lot of the people that were working with him were Scottish, and he makes this sort of little joke kind of, you know, at their expense in a more loving way than it comes across, because it comes across as very mean.
He throws shade at professions in kind of the same way that we do, like, now, yeah, too. Like, he doesn't...
Let's talk about those. Yeah, yeah, we should do good, that. They're good ones.
The first one that I came across was politician, which is, he defines as a man of artifice or one of deep contrivance.
And he also gets specific about types of politicians. So, you know, at this time, you have really two big political movements or parties in Britain. You've got the Whigs and the Tories. He describes the Tories, well, he says, he describes the word as a cant term derived, I suppose, from an Irish word signifying a savage.
Oh, fabulous.
And then on Whig, he just calls it the name of a faction. But when he's describing the word leader, he says, as the detestable Wharton was the leader of the Whigs. So he doesn't seem to like any politicians, it would appear.
He also has attorney jokes, which, like, attorney jokes are evergreen. We've been apparently doing this for all time. He observes he doesn't care to speak ill of any man behind his back, but he believes the gentleman is an attorney.
I've heard that one.
Oh, too good, too good.
Yeah, but he chooses to put that one in, you know.
He calls a patron commonly a wretch who supports with insolence and is paid with flattery. And by that, he is, I believe, referring to kind of someone who pays for artistic works.
Yes.
You know, like an art patron.
So at this point, he has had a major public falling out with his own patron, a guy called Lord Chesterfield. Lord Chesterfield writes a couple of eulogies. By eulogies, I mean, you know, they're supposed to be exultory remarks about Johnson, but Johnson considers them to be condescending. So he writes his own letter to a newspaper. Yeah, and they fall out. And then when it comes to defining the word patron, yeah, he just has another dig. I've got three sort of slightly odd professions that he does talk about. Ale conner. So ale conner came up in our episode about weird jobs. And ale conner is someone whose job is to go around and test basically the purity of the beer to make sure it's not going to make...
We decided we wanted that job.
Absolutely, absolutely. But by this point, it's clearly fallen out of favor, because he describes of an ale conner, their places are now regarded only as sinecures for decayed citizens. Basically, they're kind of pointless.
He also doesn't approve of, like, bad behavior. Like, he's not into drinking. He doesn't suffer people who are foolish or behave in ways that he doesn't think are socially acceptable, which we see frequently throughout.
He also doesn't like people who he perceives to be conning other people. He defines a palmistry, for example, so a palmist would be the profession, but he describes palmistry as the cheat of foretelling fortune by the lines of the palm.
He probably doesn't like street performers in general, because he defines a mime as a buffoon who practices gesticulations.
Buffoon. That's so harsh.
Right.
Can I just go back? We were talking about politicians and we were talking about the patron thing and how his sort of personal vendetta with Lord Chesterfield sort of creeped in there. Well, look, there are a couple of entries in here that are related to sort of politics that actually land him sort of in a little bit of hot water. I don't know if you've heard about these already, but for example, so he has the entry on pension, for which he writes, an allowance made to anyone without an equivalent. But then he goes on to say, in England, it is generally understood to mean pay given to a state hireling for treason to his country.
Oh, spicy. Yeah.
Do you know why this one comes back to bite him?
I can imagine many reasons. But...
yeah, well, he takes a kingly pension from George III of £300, which isn't too bad. And then also, sort of related, we're talking about taxes here. His description of excise is a hateful tax levied upon commodities and adjudged not by the common judges of property, but wretches hired by those to whom excise is paid.
Man, he's probably lucky that more politicians didn't read the dictionary.
he did get into trouble for this
one.
So this is the one that really does come, well, almost comes to bite him on the arse, I'd say, because the commissioners of excise were sufficiently offended by this. This is according to James Boswell, who wrote his biography and was a friend of his. Now he says, the commissioners of excise, being offended by this severe reflection, consulted Mr. Murray, the Attorney General at the time, to know whether redress could be legally obtained. Boswell though goes on to write, I am, however, informed by very good authority that its import was that the passage might be considered as actionable, but that it would be more prudent in the board not to prosecute. So basically, they want to sue him for it, but they decide that it's probably not worth their while.
Yeah, I mean, he went from being kind of a bookseller, bookish type writer who earned almost nothing to being a celebrated person by the end of his life because of this dictionary.
Yeah, in his lifetime, they're calling him Dictionary Johnson, and he is, you know, he's Johnny Big Balls down in London.
And before this, like, he was like...
Johnny Big Balls.
He, like, grew up above a bookshop. He, like, was always struggling for cash. When he was writing for the Gentleman's Magazine, that was sustaining him. Even when he married his wife, who, their relationship is actually kind of adorable.
Yeah, it's really
despite
sweet.
Despite the fact that she's dramatically older than him. It said that when she first met him, she said something like, I've never met a more sensible man in my life.
And this is interesting that it clearly didn't go down well with his family, his marriage. The reason that he gets married in Derby, where I'm from, 40 minutes drive nowadays away from Lichfield, but much longer away in the 1700s, is probably because the family didn't approve. Neither family approved, because she wasn't from those parts either. And they just wanted to get away from it all and get married somewhere else.
And they weren't together that long. She died not too long after they were married. But, like, he adored her and wrote on her gravestone that she was, in Latin, he wrote that she was beautiful, accomplished, ingenious, and pious. Which, there are a lot of words for women in this dictionary, and most of them seem to be, when he expresses disapproval, it is because they are not those things.
We should talk about women in the dictionary, actually. It is, and I don't mean that in like, let's reread the dictionary with a sort of feminist approach. That's not what I'm getting at. But for example, he describes certain words as being woman's words, which I think is quite amusing. He says that frightfully
yep,
is a woman's word.
He says it's a cant word among women for anything unpleasing. He uses the word cant a lot, and we've addressed cant words before, but it might be worth explaining. It's thought to be from the same source as chant, which is from the Latin cantus, as in religious chants and songs and literally singing. And according to the Century Dictionary, the word cant may have become associated with beggars on the notion of them like standing and repeatedly asking for alms, kind of like the church does.
Right. Yeah, sort of chanting their appeals for alms. He also says that horrid is women's cant as well. So you can only imagine women saying frightful and frightfully and horrid.
I love the notion that like women having their own dialect. Like, yeah. Which like, it's, I mean, there are gendered ways of speaking. That's not wrong. It's just very interesting to hear cant as a gendered expression, you know?
We do not talk about words as being women's or men's words. We just don't.
He also has a lot of many insulting words for women throughout the dictionary, which, I mean, they should be there because they're words that people use, but the descriptions of them are kind of funny and also express his disapproval. Like a harridan, which is a word you might still encounter today, but his definition is a decayed strumpet. At similar times, she's been described as half whore and half bawd.
Oh, Samuel.
What fun.
I mean, it's more a reflection of the times, I think, than a reflection of him. Yeah, the approach to sex workers of the day was not right. To describe them in glowing terms. It was to describe them as the lowest of the low.
But also, like, a flirt, he defines as a pert young hussy.
I feel awkward laughing at these, Jess.
They're funny.
Stop it. They are funny. They are. That is funny. The word pert is funny anywhere.
Uh-huh. Pert also comes up in the definition of the word minx, which was originally a word for a dog, by the way, but it is later a young, pert, wanton girl.
I love the idea of you just looking through the dictionary for all of these terms.
I do have like a whole chapter on bias in words from hell and just like the way we lampoon each other. Which he brings up lampoon a couple times too.
Ah, what does he have to say about it?
He distinguishes satire and lampoon. Proper satire is distinguished by the generality of the reflections from a lampoon, which is aimed at a particular person, but they are too frequently confounded, he says. You're using it wrong.
He's telling us how to laugh.
Right. A lampoon is a personal satire, particularly designed to vex someone.
He's quite easily vexed himself. It has to be said. So I was reading this is David Crystal's anthology of Samuel Johnson, right? It's brilliant. Everything that David Crystal does is brilliant. But he very helpfully pulls together certain categories of things. And one of the categories is entries where he throws shade. This is not how David Crystal phrases it. He phrased it far more eloquently than me. But where he has a go at some of the writers that he's quoting in the entries. Can I tell you a couple of those?
Yeah.
In Hyper, he writes, a word barbarously curtailed by prior from hypercritic. A hypercritic, one more critical than necessity requires. Prior did not know the meaning of the word, which I really like.
Oh, that's funny.
Under quaff, he says, Junius, with his usual idleness of conjecture, derives it from the Greek. So he's just having a go at other people who are trying to trace the sources of these. Junius is you know, an etymologist. The boom in etymology hasn't happened by this point. So his efforts to trace the origins of these words are laudable. He mainly uses just a handful of sources, but anyway, he doesn't like...
He makes some assumptions that aren't true too, yeah. Like about curmudgeon and things like that, yeah. Which I think we've addressed.
Yeah, he equates the word stallion to a Welsh word that it almost certainly doesn't come from, but it's a creative approach. And also he gets annoyed, in the entry to Scamble with an author called Merrick Castlebon, who I haven't heard of, so I'm probably mispronouncing the name. But he says, this word, which is scarcely in use, has much exercised the etymological sagacity of Merrick Castlebon, but as is usual, to no purpose.
Oh my goodness.
Just saying this guy has tried to work out where it's come from. And he's failed. To Scamble, by the way, is just an alternative version of Scramble.
It is interesting that in modern dictionaries, like they consider their job to be to document the way people use words. And he does this, but he's also like, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, he's having his prescriptive cake and eating it, isn't he? Yeah. He's being both descriptive and prescriptive.
The word precarious. He thinks everyone uses the word precarious wrong. I actually didn't know the root of this word ahead of time. Do you know what the Latin root of precarious means?
No.
Prayer. The notion is if you're in a precarious situation, the implication is that your fate hinges upon a prayer or perhaps upon the will of someone else or another divine deity or something. So, you know, it described something you hold only at someone else's mercy, like a favor that could be yoinked away. But Johnson doesn't like this usage. He defines it as dependent, uncertain, because it's depending on the will of another. And then he says, no word is more unskillfully used than this with its derivatives, because although it is used for uncertain in all its senses, it only means uncertain as if you are dependent on someone else, which feels like splitting hairs to me.
It does, yeah. It's interesting that he's picking up on it being confused with another word or consistently swapped out for another word, treated as a synonym for another word in a way that we continue to do with those same two words, I think. Precarious has taken on that exact position that he's annoyed about. That's what it means.
Exactly.
There's some unusual meanings for words that have changed. One of the ones that David Crystal points out is that tomboy in Samuel Johnson's dictionary is not specific to a female. So a guy can be a tomboy as well, which I thought was interesting.
Oh, that is interesting.
I thought it was notable that humanist in there, he describes as a philologer or a grammarian, which is not how we describe a humanist these days.
More like humanities.
Yeah. So right.
Touches on that notion.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's just, and you might use it like that now, but it's just even more specific than that, right? He's talking about people who are interested in words. I guess that means he would probably call himself a humanist, perhaps. Also, romp, his definition of romp as a noun is a rude, awkward, boisterous, untaught girl. There you go, one for your list.
Yeah, there you go. There we are.
And what I also thought was interesting was his definition of sneaker, which is a large vessel of drink. So before it was a shoe, it was something to sup your beer out of.
Sneak a little drink, you know?
There we go. Yeah, maybe that's it. Except maybe
a big one.
Yeah, and he defines storyteller, strapping, and sturdy in negative terms. All of those terms that we now use as flattery, and it describes someone as sturdy or strapping. That's good, but he, in his reckoning, they're negative, or they can be negative. And storyteller is essentially a liar.
The entry for the word compliment makes me want to give my boy Sammy a big old hug, because obviously his friends are kind of bitchy. He defines it as an act or expression of civility, usually understood to include some hypocrisy and to mean less than it declares. In other words, a compliment is a lie. He also continues, he says, this is properly complement with the E in the middle, something superfluous or more than enough. And he's alluding to the fact that despite the way we distinguish them now, compliment and compliment are etymologically identical. Doublets. They, the things that complete compliment is verbal praise for you saw for someone in conversation, adjusted its spelling via Latin with the I, and I'm sorry, via Italian with the I in the middle of the word, and where it had become an expression of respect or civility, perhaps something that suits you or fluffs up your ego a bit. But Johnson doesn't like the Italian sense and considers it to be disingenuous.
He's actually very well, not actually, I mean, he's famed for being very good at explaining what words mean. I mean, yeah. Sometimes he gets criticized for using more complicated explanations than the word that you start off with. You know, he'll use synonyms that are more complex than the original word. But he does point out I can't remember if it was in the preface to the dictionary. I think it is. He sort of excuses this in advance by pointing out that, you know, if a foreigner comes to his book trying to understand the English language, they'll find these more complex words that are usually borrowings from another language. It's a good way to get to the origin of the English word. And he's right about that. I mean, it does help.
A good example is, and this isn't a word we use now, as far as I know, maybe someone does. Someone's going to be like, yes, I use this word daily, but it's clangular.
Yeah, sure.
It's another word for clandestine, and it's loosely related to the word clandestine, but he uses clandestine as the definition. So it's like, you have to know what clandestine means too. But he also adds secret and private and concealed and obscure. Clanculum was a Latin word meaning secretly, and it's a diminutive of the Latin word, not the English word clam, which also means secretly. This is interesting to me because to clam up is a relatively modern slang term referring to the notion of like clams closing their shells so you shut up. But in 14th century English, clam was also an interjection meaning be quiet, and it may have been a reference to the Latin word instead.
So the thing shuts, right?
Yeah, it does. But these words are unrelated. Like a clam is the sea creature is not named after the Latin word for secret stuff.
We were just talking about the sort of the synonyms that he provides with the entries. And for one entry, for the word careless, he provides no fewer than 12 synonyms as his definition. He writes, without care, without solicitude, unconcerned, negligent, inattentive, heedless, regardless, thoughtless, neglectful, unheeding, unthinking, unmindful, with, of, or about.
Stop, okay. It's already dead.
Not all necessary, but he is very thorough. For example, for the word comet, he writes a 750 word explanation. I am taking all this direct from David Crystal's research here, by the way. Yeah, David Crystal mentioned that because he doesn't actually include these words in the books. They're too big. The entries are too long, you know.
You mentioned words where he throws shade at the author using them. Alexander Pope used the word ridative to correspond with talkative. And so the definition is a word of Pope's not to be imitated. Increase of years makes men more talkative, but less ridative. Which, I mean, I think Pope's being funny, right? But I would use it. That sounds funny.
I like ridative. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. We we're running a little short on time, so I think we should address some of the like antiquated and or obscure words that would be useful to bring back from the dictionary. One of them, I think, which is nicely elegant, is afterwit. It's the same thing as staircase wit, but I like it because it doesn't necessarily require a staircase. It more accurately describes what you're doing. It's like you come up with something smart to say after you've had a conversation.
I much prefer afterwit because the staircase wit always requires that explanation, doesn't it?
Yeah.
To the unacquainted, whereas afterwit immediately makes sense. One that I like is back friend. We've come across this. So this is a friend backwards, he defines it as. That is an enemy in secret. Ooh, someone who's pretending to be a friend. He also uses mouth friend. That's in there as well, which he describes as one who professes friendship without intending it.
That doesn't sound like what that means to me.
A mouth friend. Just. We didn't do the rude words. I've just realized I managed to skip past them.
Another fun one here, which is kind of gnarly, but also like, this is a word that in my 30s comes up more often than I would hope, is the word niterosity.
Oh, which
is,
God.
This one's so cited gross. Really frequently. It's erectation with the taste of undigested roast meat. So it's a meat burp.
Beefy burp. Disgusting.
Fun fact, though, in Latin, this was also a concept and a word that was used in classical Latin. Nidoricupius, which was a word for someone who loves the smell of cooking. So like the root here means like steam, fumes, or an aroma specifically of food.
Yeah, I can draw a nice little link here because there's this other word that he includes, which is smell feast, which he describes as a parasite, one who haunts good tables. So this is someone who somehow manages to consistently con their way into banquets. Right? They're a parasite. But I saw one description that said that they were attracted by the nidorous smells of the table. So the meaty smells of the table.
The cartoon character like floating through the air on the scent of a delicious pie or something like that.
Yeah. I put this word in my newsletter recently and I said, I think it's an appropriate one to use, a smell feast for, you know, the teenager who comes back only when there's food on the table, only to leave once more just after dessert. You know, someone who's only really around when they can stuff their face and then they're off again.
Another one you see mentioned a lot, like this one comes up because it seems so utterly random, is anatiferous, which means producing ducks. And it is from the Latin anatis, which means ducks. So it's fun. It means like carrying ducks.
Carrying ducks.
Yeah, bearing ducks. It's the F-E-R on the end is the Latin for like carrying.
I say bearing. I thought you meant like giving birth
to
ducks.
Oh, no, not giving birth to ducks.
Who does that apply to other than ducks?
I think that could also be interpreted that way. I mean, I don't know how many people are anatiferous in their lives unless they have ducks.
I don't know. That word is somewhat horisonous. Horisonus, that's a word that he uses for sounding dreadful.
He does say that anatiferous is not in use, but he quotes, let's see, if there be anatiferous trees whose corruption breaks forth into barnacles. Oh, this is like a barnacle goose thing. We should do a bestiary episode.
Yeah. You introduced me to bestiaries. I didn't really know much about them. These
medieval bestiaries are wild. The barnacle goose is a figure, and we should get into that another time because it's a whole story.
I cannot wait. Any more fun words from Samuel Johnson?
A jig and bob.
Jig and bob.
Jig and bob.
Does that mean what it sounds like? Does that mean something that's just sort of
a trinket, a knick-knack, a slight contrivance in machinery, which he's tolerant of this one, but not twiddle twaddle.
Yeah, it's funny that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I like that word, but not this one. He has a couple of like cute definitions too, like for hiss. He notes that it is remarkable that this word cannot be pronounced without making the noise it signifies, which is also true of like a lot of onomatopoetic words and things like that. But I do like that he notes that on hiss.
Yeah, hiss, mm-hmm. Like lisp and... Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also like his, he likes the word agog, he seems to anyway, which means he just defines as in a state of desire, in a state of imagination, heated with the notion of some enjoyment or longing. Agog, in case you were unaware, is from the old French en gauge. I don't know how to pronounce it in French, but it means in jest, basically, or in good humor, from the French word for, the old French word for fun.
Okay, so that doesn't really imply it's current meaning.
Yeah, no, it's very different. But it could also mean like joyfulness. So I think maybe, and agog, I feel like is more like, I feel like it pairs well with aghast.
Yeah, or agape. Yeah, these words have kind of, they've probably influenced each other, the meanings.
Right, because they get put together a lot.
he describes a syncopist as a contractor of words.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, someone who shortens words.
Like syncopation.
Exactly, like syncopation, musical syncopation.
This is a note on, this is one of your definitions earlier where I'm surprised you didn't get in trouble for it, and maybe he did, but the definition for heresy is an opinion of private men different from that of the Catholic and Orthodox Church.
Oh yeah, he doesn't have much time for the Catholics, does he? Mm-hmm. He also, his description of Reformation and Reformer are all about how excellent it is to get away from the popish types and the popish ways.
I do think it's interesting that nincompoop and curmudgeon he has incorrect origins for. He's the one who notes non compos mentis is a possible origin of nincompoop, which we've addressed before, is not where it comes from. Probably not anyway.
Yeah, we don't actually know.
Yeah,
no one actually knows, but probably
not. And then curmudgeon is not from the French for like a broken heart or a wicked heart, but is probably a mashup of like corn merchant, or it could just be like mudgeon could be from a Gaelic word meaning a disagreeable person.
Corn merchant.
Yeah, but it's probably not that. It's probably the Gaelic word.
That's rubbish. Yeah. I hate that. I don't like that at all. I don't like the idea that it's just a slur word and that becomes it.
Back to our words that you could borrow for future use. I challenge you to introduce any of these into your lexicon this week. One of them is ophiophagus, which is serpent eating, you know, as you do. Another one is galariculate, which means covered with a hat. Or sorry, galariculate, if it's an adjective. Yeah. So yeah, covered with a hat.
Galariculate today?
This one may be more useful. Blunderhead, which is a stupid fellow, adult, or a thick skull. Or a fopdoodle, which is a foolish or insignificant person.
Yeah. Those ones sound like what they are, right?
Exactly.
Those ones are all right. Well, as we round this off, can I leave you with a merry thought?
Yeah.
Which is the definition of the word merry thought, which is actually not what you'd expect, because I bet you're guessing, if you're watching this, that, oh, it's just a happy thought, right? A merry thought. Right. But no, it's not. It is a forked bone on the body of fowls.
It's a wishbone.
So-called because boys and girls pull in play at both sides, the longest part broken off, betokening priority of marriage.
That's adorable.
Sweet little word for your personal lexicon. Merry thought. But what he has done for our collective lexicon, Samuel Johnson, we're very, very grateful to him for it, Dictionary Johnson, the harmless drudge.
He's such a delight. You can access the entire dictionary online. So we highly recommend jumping in and digging around for some treasure, because every single definition has a little something to look at.
Yeah. And if you are a true word nerd, that's where you should go next. After that, go to our shop, get yourself a word nerd t-shirt, as I've been wearing all the way through this episode. It's bringing me great inspiration.
We do have a new design in there this week too. It pertains to animal collectives.
So it's so good. Let's leave that as a little tease. But if you like your crazy collective now, so we've got a very special one for you that we just put up over there.
Very fun.
Congrats again on the hard copy of your book, Jess.
Thank you. It's coming out on October 7th, so grab yourself one. It's very pretty, and I'm very happy. And Samuel Johnson makes several appearances throughout. So
glorious. Thank you very much for watching or listening to this episode of Words Unraveled. We'll catch you next time.